This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine yourself sitting in the jury box, and instead of the prosecutor telling you how the defendant picked up a gun and shot his wife in the back, the prosecutor dims the lights and rolls a videotape. There you see an animated figure of a man, gun in hand. A woman in a nightgown falls to the ground as shots are fired. You have just virtually witnessed the alleged crime. This hour, we're going to talk about forensic computer animation. It has been used for many years to illustrate civil cases, now and increasingly is being used to illustrate criminal cases. How was the animation created, and how might it change what juries hear and see in the courtroom? Can a jury be prejudiced by virtually witnessing a crime, as opposed to just being told about it? If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you're invited to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my first guests. Stephen Bro is a forensic animator with Perceptual Motion Incorporated in Gig Harbor, Washington. He joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Bro.
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
Good afternoon to you. Andre Stewart is a forensic animator and the president and chief executive officer of 21st Century Forensic Animations in Arlington, Texas. And he joins us from the studios of member station KERA in Dallas. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Stewart.
Good afternoon.
The Honorable James Rosenbaum is the chief judge of the U.S. Federal District Court for the District of Minnesota. He joins us by phone from his chambers in Minneapolis. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Good afternoon. Stephen Bro, what kind of events do you typically animate?
Most of the events that I animate are automotive accident reconstructions that are being used in courtrooms to settle civil litigation.
And now they're finding their way into criminal courtrooms?
They are increasingly approaching that area, yes.
Now, how do you create an animated event? What information do you rely on?
Basically, the underlying information is that which is used by the accident reconstructionists who are testifying as expert witnesses, either for a defendant or a plaintiff in a civil lawsuit, or if it's a criminal case, it might be something along the lines of a vehicular manslaughter case where either the prosecutor's office has retained accident reconstructionists or the defendant's attorney has retained their own expert witnesses. So the preliminary information that's going to be used is something along the lines of all of the information that concerns the scene where the accident occurred. The reconstructionists will go there and gather data, including measurements of the roadways, and they will sometimes use as-built diagrams from the roads department, aerial photographs. They will use evidence from the police report concerning the points of impact. They will take the physical evidence at the scene into consideration. And then they will produce an accident reconstruction based upon various formulas that they use to determine the velocities of the vehicles, both pre and post impact. I will create a three-dimensional scene in virtual space in a computer animation software program that involves all of the objects that are in the scene. And then I will use the accident reconstructionist data to determine how fast the vehicles within the scene should move. We create virtual camera viewpoints to view the scene through. And then once everything is animated, the view is rendered through the viewpoint of those cameras and images are produced. You produce approximately several seconds worth of animation. You get 30 frames or images per second. And as those are rendered out, they're then played back in real time, 30 frames per second, and recorded to videotape. And that tape is then edited to include things like overlays or transitions or title captions, whatever the expert witness and the attorneys decide needs to be shown to the jury. And then that is used as an exhibit in court to illustrate the findings of the accident reconstructionist.
Andre Stewart, is there a is there an actual software package made for the legal field on this?
It's not exactly one particular software package. The typical or the typical base animation package is a product by Kinetics, but you have to have a milieu of other softwares. We have four softwares for trees and two softwares for fires and three softwares for smokes and softwares for human motion. And so it's not just one particular package. You have to incorporate a lot of different softwares to generate images that are allowable in court.
So you're not going to have a software that creates skid marks for a 57 Chevy going 70 miles an hour, something like that?
Not exactly.
Yeah. And what is Stephen Breaux? What and I ask both of you, what is the advantage of having an event animated? I've read when you show these animations in court, the juries, the spectators just gasp sometimes.
Well, that's the primary benefit of a forensic animation, is that it does grab the jury's attention. And there have been numerous studies, both in the fields of jury research and psychology and in the legal field, that show that juries have a tendency to retain, to recall, and to believe things that they see over things that they hear. So when you have an expert witness testifying on various things like the yaw rate of a vehicle that's spinning out of control, or coefficient of friction and determining the length of a skid mark and using that to determine the speed of a vehicle, things like that, even with very good accident reconstructionists, a lot of jurors don't either understand it or it starts to put them to sleep a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you can show them something like that, it really grabs their attention and they have a tendency to believe it more than if they just heard it.
Judge Rosenbaum, does it prejudice the jury to see it rather than hear about it?
Well, if a trial is conducted well, all the evidence will prejudice the jury. It just depends on in which direction. Each side wants to prejudice the jury in their own way. Does it overly prejudice the jury? I don't think so. What you heard in the earlier description is there is a certain amount of physical facts which simply exist. The length of the skid mark, the condition of the automobile when it was finished at the end of the skid, if you will, whether or not there are marks on the curb where it must have rolled over at a certain point, where it came out at the end, where the trees are. The reconstruction has to match the uncontroverted physical evidence that's found. Then what you do is try and make a reasoned analysis of what must have happened. That, at least, is the theory. Both sides, in any case like this, it doesn't just come out of the woodwork. Someone doesn't just walk in and say, here, we're going to show this now. They have long in advance shown it to the other side, which will have its own set of experts who will look at whatever's produced, and if it doesn't match up with the known facts, there's two possibilities. One is they'll let me know, and I would keep that kind of evidence out. The other is if you can show it's false, there's nothing as powerful as showing that the other side has definitely lied.
Mm-hmm. So you get to see the animation before it's shown to the jury?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this goes from as simple as if somebody's going to be speaking from a set of photo boards or picture boards and use those when they present things to the jury, we see those in advance. We'd see any piece of evidence that there was any question about in advance, particularly electronic evidence, which you frequently have long discussions about long in advance of the trial.
What if one side presents animation? Does the jury assume because the other side has no rebuttal animation that its case is not as solid?
I think in general, most lawyers will tell you that given the right set of facts, they are the best lawyer in the world. I have seen a number of cases where one side had much more technology than the other, but nowhere near as good a set of facts, and the jury sees through that in a heartbeat. On the other hand, if you have a good piece of evidence and you are able to show that it conforms with what appears to be objective truth, that itself is very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Breaux, if two animators are working with the same data, will their end product look the same?
It would be very surprising if they did look the same, because just as with motion pictures, you end up with a certain amount of artistic license of what's being shown. Some things have to be decided upon in a collaborative effort between the animator, the accident reconstructionist or other expert witness, and the attorney who's putting forth the case in court. Things like the camera positions and angles that are going to be used. Things like, to some degree, the lighting, although usually that's predefined. The way that the animations are edited together. A classic example from motion picture industry, for example, is the way that Alfred Hitchcock made the original Psycho, and then several years ago, someone else made another version of Psycho with the exact same script, the exact same scenes, but somehow the two movies are still different. I think the same thing would be true if Andre Stewart and I were both given the exact same set of information from a forensic or from an accident reconstructionist or from some other forensic expert. Mm-hmm. We would come up with two animations that, while at their core, are identical. The key framing would be the same. The dimensions of the roadway would be the same. Things like that would all be identical. But they would look a little different, at least somewhat different from one another.
Andre, I would imagine that the camera angle would be very important in difference and in convincing a jury.
It is, because different views offer different information. As Stephen was talking about the a motor vehicle accident, often a plan view gives a very good perspective in terms of looking at things, how the actors come together without a perspective. Let's say if it's a sightline obstruction, then if you put a camera within the vehicle, you are able to evaluate what the view is from that vehicle and if a sightline obstruction did occur. In the criminal case you were referring to earlier at the top of the show, those were important to look outside to see the positional relationships. So it's not just empirical information, but there's also still some strategy information that's decided by the counsel about how to best present his case with this information and with this ability to view things through animation.
Are there some facts of the case that that you cannot animate? For example, if we take a car, for example, driving and the driver's tried to brake, can you say how hard the driver tried to brake in the animation, or is that something you can't reflect?
Well, an expert will definitely have to make that calculation. It's the laws of physics, and you know Uncle Newton has these three laws you can't break. And as long as there's sufficient data, information on the roadway about perhaps skid or some braking information from some vehicles, some actual commercial vehicles have recorders on board, you can gather information from that and input it into the animation. But there's different components. You look at how energy is transferred. Crush is one, post-separation travel, and how far they travel from their original path. So each little piece of information is gathered, and an expert who's making the reconstruction, who's testifying about the events, has to incorporate all of that into his reconstruction.
Judge Rosenbaum, if one side has an animation and the other side can't afford to make one, is that in itself not a fair trial?
That's a very interesting and a difficult question. First of all, I think it's commonly thought that one side will always have it and the other side won't. And that happens less frequently than you would think. In the case, one of the cases that I had where computer animation was used, it was in fact the defendant, and the defendant was being represented by a public defender. The defender came, and the judge has control of defender funds, and said, we need this to illustrate our theory of the case, and I authorized the expenditure. So in that case, one side had it, that was the defense, and the prosecution did not have one. And the net result of it was is the defendant was convicted regardless of whether or not he had a television show or didn't have a television show.
Hmm. And so where did you get the money from?
You.
Taxpayers.
That's taxpayers' money.
The taxpayers paid for that. But you thought it was worthwhile enough in this age that it should be done.
Well, I thought it was appropriate. They were describing. You said there's some things that can't be shown.
Yeah,
absolutely. There's some things that cannot be shown. The most important thing in a criminal case is intent.
Right.
And intent cannot be shown. What you can show, for instance, I recently saw a television show again about the reconstruction of the. Sam Shepard, his wife's killing.
Right.
Where later on, forensic experts apparently have been able to reconstruct the fact that a person who was right-handed could not have left the spatter marks, or left-handed, I don't remember which one it was, on the wall that would have matched what was obviously and clearly found at the scene. Well, it would be interesting and useful to show graphically, visually, if the technology had been available at the time, that this man could not have done what he was accused of having done.
Judge Rosenbaum, I'm going to have to ask you to stop there. You have to overrule the judge at this case. So stay with us. We have to take a break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about forensic animation and about using computer animation in the courtroom with my guests, Judge James Rosenbaum, Chief Judge of the U.S. Federal District Court for the District of Minnesota, Stephen Breaux, forensic animator at Perceptual Motion in Gig Harbor, Washington, and Andre Stewart, a forensic animator at the 21st Century Forensic Animations in Arlington, Texas. And now we've been talking about forensic animation, which is just an example of how technology is changing the way courtrooms work. Here's another example. Joining me to talk about some of the changes we might see further down the road is Frederick Lederer. He's the Chancellor Professor of Law and the Director of the Courtroom 21 Project at the Marshall Wythe Law School at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Now, you're looking at the use of virtual reality in the courtroom. Tell us about that.
Well, every year we do a high-tech experimental laboratory trial, and I've had the pleasure, for instance, having Judge Rosenbaum assist us in that as well in past years. This year, we wanted to experiment with immersive virtual reality in a simulated criminal prosecution, so that's what we did.
How does that work? What do you mean? Describe for us what... We don't know what it looks like, what virtual reality is, how that would work in the courtroom.
Many of the listeners will probably have seen this occasionally in malls in a more elementary form. You go ahead and put on a headset, and suddenly, according to your eyes anyway, and then the rest of you tends to follow what your eyes tell you, you're in another world, all of which is being created by the computer. And you can actually walk around in a room or an outside setting, and it feels as if you're actually there. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not yet photographic realistic, so we're not quite in the realm of science fiction, but much farther along than I would have thought possible.
So in a practical case, then every member of the jury would be wearing a headset with the goggles, the virtual reality in them, and they would be transported to the scene of the crime or some other place?
It's theoretically possible. We may try that in a few years, but the difficulty with that is that unless we're going to let them all get up out of the jury box, and yeah. I'm not sure if Judge Rosenbaum would permit that, they're going to be mostly passive observers at the moment. In the case we just tried this past April, instead we had the witnesses put that on and then let the jurors see it on a displayed screen as the witnesses were able to move within the three-dimensional virtual recreation of an operating room theater.
All right, tell us about that case. The witnesses were then brought back to an operating room and... What were they watching?
Our case was unusual. We had a medical startup company that had invented a stent that went into an artery that would cleanse it of cholesterol, but without going through all the facts, unfortunately, it wasn't tested properly. It killed its first patient. And in our simulated case, they were indicted and charged in federal court with having killed the patient with manslaughter. The defense theory was that it wasn't the device that had done it, it was the surgeon who'd put it in upside down. There was a real question, though, whether the witness, a nurse, could actually have seen the surgeon's hands. And that's what was all shown with the virtual reality. We put them right back in the operating room. It was all done by a wonderful team from the University of California at Santa Barbara. And they went ahead and showed us what could be seen. Each witness resumed the place he or she had in the operating room, and we could see exactly what they could see and what they could not see.
Interesting. Judge Rosenbaum, what do you think of this?
I think it would be very interesting. Actually, what he's describing is not only not science fiction, it is quite possible right now that a surgeon in Santa Barbara could operate on a patient who's at... William and Mary Law School, with a robot system operated, with a doctor looking through the same kind of goggles they're describing. I think, realistically, once again, each side would have access to the material. I think at this moment we're probably talking 5 to 10 years in the future, and I don't exactly see if it's likely to occur the way they've described it, but it's not beyond the realm of the possible.
Mm-hmm. And Frederick... This was not a real case, was it? This was a an experimental case.
No, this is not a real case. Yeah. This was an experimental trial conducted with the help of the Federal Judicial Center in Washington, in which we were trying out this and many other forms of technology, including holographic evidence and the like. Mm-hmm. What is somewhat surprising is that the team of experts who did this did it very inexpensively, and they in fact are available for to assist attorneys in real cases. Now, whether a judge would permit this to happen in a real case is another issue.
All right, let's go to the phones because we have a lot of listeners asking Talmudic questions this afternoon, so let's go to that. Jeff in Laramie, Wyoming. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it sounds like a great idea as far as civil cases and maybe the sentencing phase of a criminal case. The problem that I have in a criminal case would be the defendant being able to confront their witnesses. I mean, when you question your forensic witnesses, you're questioning them each separately. But the image seems to formulate this picture of basically an eyewitness account that comprised together, it would be difficult to confront your witnesses.
So there's no real eyewitness, you're saying, who created one person who...
Right, exactly. It's like formulations of one eyewitness account. But I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Judge Rosenbaum, how do you react to that? How do you, you know, the fact that this is a composite made of different... different angles and actually there's a lot of art involved here. How do you confront that as you might in a jury, a case where you can actually have a witness on the stand there?
Well, I think on one level, I think what he's suggesting is a person is always entitled to be in the same room as their accuser. Mm-hmm. The person who says you broke the law ought to be present with you. Now, in this case, what I just got done trying a case involving a killing in that took place near a gas station, and there was a very carefully constructed model of the gas station, and you could see where things were, where automobiles were, and items like that. There's no question that the information came in through the witness. The model was there, which helped the jury conceive of what was going on. I think the analogy would hold. If there were a computer simulation, it's not much different, other than you would see it perhaps from other angles, than you might from the model that's there. The testimony would still be, or for the person who introduces it, the information of the facts would still be the facts that are known, and they have to be related in a certain sense. So I don't think you really have a confrontation problem. It's an interesting question, but right now I don't think that would probably carry the day.
Ira, if I could interject.
Yes, go ahead.
Every animation has to have an author, has to have a sponsor, and be it a criminologist or somebody who's well-versed in firearms or a police officer, a detective who has gone through all the information, scene inspection, coroner's report, etc. This is the individual who's actually sponsoring the exhibit. And so this is bringing to life their testimony. So in terms of being able to contradict or trying to knock out an animation, that animation is built upon his or her testimony. So that's where the foundation mm-hmm. lies.
Mm-hmm. Do you put the actual face of the defendant in the picture?
In the animation, yes. Yes, there's some various rulings across the country, and one of them is substantially similar. And one of the issues in this particular case in Pennsylvania is that we wanted to have the animation substantially similar because this was the first animation ever admitted into Pennsylvania criminal courts. And so we wanted to have the decedent look like the decedent and the defendant look like the defendant.
Yeah, you didn't describe that case. Was that a case where he admitted he had killed his wife?
His self-defense was that she was attempting to do harm to him with a knife. And basically, the animation was simply about the ballistic, the trajectory paths, and their relationship to each other within mm-hmm. the living room.
So and there was no doubt. There was no doubt who had committed the crime here. But in cases where the defendant says, I wasn't even in the room or in the state when that happened, do you, as a rule, put the face of the defendant on the scene, which would be, you know, stating a fact that might convey that something, you know, that might not have happened there?
If that's the expert's testimony and he can substantiate it, then yes, it is.
If I might briefly, as yes. a law professor, I would suggest that we would have problems making it that photorealistic. and would prefer that if we're illustrating something, that we prefer not to make it that personalized. Perhaps the earliest use of animations in criminal cases, or at least one of the earliest in the Mitchell brothers' murder trial, used an almost robot-looking elementary construction that was highly effective and was used in order to show where the people were, the bullet trajectories, and the rest. That partially sidesteps the issue of the unfair prejudice, as it's called, to the defendant.
Hmm. Judge Rosenbaum, do you allow the face of the defendant who claims he wasn't there to be in the picture?
Well, I think my tendency would probably be not to.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's very hard to just conjure up a question, but if the question, as was just indicated, I think it was by Mr. Stewart, was the trajectory and the physical relationships, there's no reason to have the faces there.
Right.
You're dealing with a question basically of physics and of spatial relationships. There's no particular, I mean, then you get into the real authorship stuff. Do you show the guy with the Richard Nixon 5 o'clock shadow?
Mm-hmm.
Do you show him scowling? Do you show him leering? Do you show her shock and terror? And I mean, you can play these games a million ways, and the answer is there's no expert in the world who's going to testify that those kinds of things are valid. They just can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Brough?
I think that in most cases where there are human participants in a crime scene that's taking place in an animation, it's preferable not to include details such as the actual face of the defendant. If there's a question as to who committed the crime, and you include the person's face, and from a technical aspect, that's extremely easy to do. You simply take a photograph of the defendant and you scan mm-hmm. it, and then you use it as a bitmap on the face of the character in the animation. You could put anyone's face on there.
Right.
And the problem there is that you then have the jury seeing that person committing the crime. And even if they understand that it's only one side's representation of what happened, seeing that face on the character committing the crime could easily prejudice a jury. If there isn't any question as to whether or not the person actually committed the crime, but if they're claiming that they have justification or something along those lines, then again, I don't see any reason why you have to include the face. It's far, far safer to simply use mannequin-type actors carrying out the crime. In the Mitchell brothers case cited earlier, there was an initial objection that the animation shouldn't be shown because it would prejudice the jury. They're going to see the defendant committing the crime. And the court ruled that, well, okay, we'll just use stand-in mannequins going through the motions mm-hmm. without the person's face and so forth. Later, they objected that the animation shouldn't have been shown because it looked like it was a nutty android carrying out these crimes. So they tried to have their cake and eat it, too. In either event, the convictions were upheld.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones.
That's exactly the case. You do get in a two-edged sword there where they say, oh, it's simply just a cartoon.
Well, that's why we have judges. That's why we have judges to decide these things.
Exactly.
I wish I was as optimistic about that as you are.
Well, I have the luxury of being on this side.
So. I see.
Let me go to the phones to John. And is it Methuen, Massachusetts?
Methuen.
Go ahead.
Ira. Thank you for a great show. You're always giving me something new to think about. My question has to do with how do you know that the renderings are really correct to the law of the physics, you know, that the variables and constants from one software program to another are the same? And then who would be liable if some of this information were distorted? So that's my question, and I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks. All right. Thanks for calling. Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. How do we trust the animator, Andre?
That's why we have Stephen Brough. We send over our data set. If Stephen Brough would be on the opposing side, we would send our data set to Stephen, and he would look at it, and he can verify it and analyze it. And that's why each party has their own access to various experts.
So they have to have their own expert knowing that something's happened. How expensive?
The data set is just simply too complex.
Let me suggest, however, that John raised a very interesting question, and one that I think really goes to the role that we play in juries in cases and to the jobs that we do when we try cases. Each one of them made an approximation of whatever they're showing. Andre does one, Stephen does one. But both of them will tell you that this is not what happened. It is an approximation.
Exactly.
It probably couldn't have happened exactly the way they showed it, but under any circumstances, it didn't happen. And yet we admit it for the substantive truth. And we do so because we believe that what we're showing approximates maybe as well as my description of an eyewitness of what I thought I saw or what I perceived. But the reality is it's not like admitting a four-pound rock, which will be a four-pound rock, which will be a four-pound rock. This is a different kind of evidence, and we need to understand that.
If one of the counsel finds the slightest bit of discrepancy, like maybe there is a skid mark missing that really was on the scene, would then that be easy then to just knock out the whole animation as being, gee, if there's that one little discrepancy, the rest of it's garbage also?
If it were perceived to have been left out, particularly on purpose and particularly by way of cheating, I think it would be an unbelievably powerful piece of evidence against the side that offered it.
Dr. Lederer, what do you say?
Keep in mind that every witness gives an approximation of the facts as the witness perceived and understands them and communicates them. Everything that Judge Rosenbaum said is, of course, accurate, as it always is in his case. The problem here is how, on the one hand, how much accuracy will we insist on as a matter of law to allow for a judge to allow a jury to consider the evidence, and then to what extent will the jury decide to give it credence? I mean, the jury will not be surprised if the other side has a minor disagreement on the facts. If there's a massive disagreement on the facts, well, that's a more substantial issue. One thought, however, is worth mentioning here, too, as well. Keep in mind that what we are doing, however, is making the case more complicated, because now, in order to be sure that we check the accuracy of the animation, the other side does have to go ahead and potentially have access to it, and that means the other side may now need expertise it did not used to need. It was one thing to be concerned about cross-examination of the other side's witnesses. Now this is simply an outgrowth of the expansion of the use of expert testimony and all that comes with it.
And it makes it much more expensive, too. Andre, what does it cost to make an animation?
Most typical animations run between $6,000 and $12,000, but it can get into six figures if you go into some very complex ones.
How many seconds is $10,000?
A minute, perhaps.
And so,
60 seconds.
And if you want to show it really more detail, as you see, it could run into six figures pretty easily.
It takes about an hour.
We've used lengthy ones that are probably over $100,000.
Actually, and those things are not beyond, particularly in some civil cases. In patent cases, it is not at all infrequent to have a number of different kinds of animations of extremely high power. Now, they fund these things out of their own, but these can be a real enterprise.
Is it going to be rare to find a criminal case that doesn't have the animation in it soon?
Yes.
Yes.
I disagree with that. I mean, in a bank robbery, you're going to have bank robbery stills from the cameras. You're going to have the bank tellers, and what do you need an animation for?
All right. Let me once again interrupt. I keep interrupting you, Judge. I'm sorry. You have great points to make, but we're coming at the end of the break, and I don't want the break to interrupt you, so we'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding, the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You can wear shorts without worrying. A new study shows light on the back of the knees does not affect our internal clocks, as some had thought.
We woke them up from sleep, maintained everyone in complete darkness, And we had technicians enter the room wearing night vision goggles.
Strange research, stranger findings. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation's Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan and his guests on Monday in this hour for a sneak preview of the fall TV season. We're talking today this hour about the courtroom of the future with my guests, James Rosenbaum, Chief Judge of the U.S. Federal District Court for the District of Minnesota, Stephen Bro, Forensic Animator at Perpetual Motion, Andre Stewart, Forensic Animator at 21st Century Forensic Animations, Frederick Lederer, Chancellor, Professor of Law, and Director of the Courtroom 21 Project. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Dan in Manteca? Dan, are you there? Dan's not there. I'll tell you, he's going to ask Dr. Lederer, how is virtual reality any better than the actual filming of something? What's the advantage there?
From my personal experience, what I've seen, you're just taking the level of detail to the next level in turn. What you're now doing is you're able to see. You're not just looking at what's being shown to you. You can turn yourself. You can see what the witness would have seen if he had looked over his shoulder. You can tell if we could ever agree on the actual underlying facts, as Judge Rosenbaum pointed out earlier, which is a critical issue, that, gee, I can't see the window where the perpetrator allegedly was. I've got a tree branch right in my face. Mm-hmm. It also has an emotional impact because you actually feel very much as if you're there. And if we keep developing the technology as we seem to be, at some point we will actually be able to let you think you're there, and that is a significant issue.
Let's go to Ken in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
Yes, I just wanted to call in. I was a prosecutor in Broward County State Attorney's Office in Fort Lauderdale for the last 16 years up until 2 months ago. And back in 1992, I did the first computer animation, which was upheld in the first criminal case in the United States, upheld with a written appellate opinion upholding its use. And I wanted to comment that I have to tell you, I've used this technology at least three or four times in court, as recently as last year in a big first-degree murder case where I prosecuted a 12-year-old who killed a little 6-year-old girl. And the animation is a very, very persuasive tool that all attorneys could use in court. I don't think it's a difficult predicate or manner to get it into evidence in a trial. I really don't think it's a matter of whether or not the computer animation is an approximation. The way I would get it into evidence and the way I have and the way the opinion in the Pierce versus State of Florida treated it was I got it in as a visualization of my expert's opinion. So rather than an approximation, whoever your expert is in whatever field of expertise they have, if they use the animation as a demonstrative aid to aid the jury in understanding their testimony, then the cross-examination goes to the expert and the expert's opinion and whether or not it's a valid opinion or not. And not so much the animation. The animation is only like a photograph or a map or any type of artwork. Every artist might do it differently. There might be different detail. But the bottom line is the underlying opinion in which the animation is based on.
Is that the case you were talking about with the 16-year-old who did that wrestling hold?
Actually, it was a 12-year-old, and he did it was a wrestling defense where they claimed that professional wrestling is the reason why he killed the little girl.
Is that the case you're speaking of?
That's the case I'm speaking of that I used the animation recently, the one that I actually did the first animation in the state of Florida in a criminal case, and the first in the United States, is called State versus Pierce. And in that case, it was a truck that ran off the road and hit a group of five little children, killing a six-year-old girl in that case.
And in both of these cases, do you think that you could have won the cases without the animation?
Well, I don't think it's that simple. I think I could have won the cases without the animation. All an animation is a very powerful tool to communicate to the jurors what the evidence is in the case. You can sometimes take hours or days of expert testimony, and you can boil it down into a minute or 2 minutes in an animation to aid the jury in understanding the testimony. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very powerful tool, and it's very simple for any attorney to understand how to use it and get it into evidence.
I'll see if there are any comments from all the folks on my side. A couple.
I think that his description of the way it conveys information is very important. As a convenient example, a couple of months ago, I had a case involving coronary stents. Coronary stent is the things that they put up through catheters and put into people's hearts. To describe that to a lay jury who knows about as much as most any other group of 12 people you take in off the road, it takes a long time. But a 40-second animation showing the human physiology, the way things move, how it expands, what it would look like expanded, and how the blood flow would increase, is an enormous amount of information conveniently given in a very short period of time.
All right, Ken, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Andre Stewart, you produced an animation for NBC depicting the killing of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman in the O.J. case. And you portrayed the killer as a tall African-American male, and you were criticized for that.
Why? Oh, yes.
You still stand behind it, I'm sure. Why did you make that choice?
Basically, the NBC had wanted to do the prosecution's position, mm-hmm. and there was a variety of evidence, like the cap, which found African-American hair inside, the stress loading on the right-handed glove, the nature of the wounds, it defines a certain kinematic nature of the individual. So each one of those individual components came together to produce and lay down mm-hmm. the foundation. The animation was simply just a presentation of injury sequencing and the kinematics.
Now, it was never used in the trial, correct?
It was for NBC. It was during all that heyday when the trial was going on.
Now, what if the Simpson defense team had come to you and said, we want you to make another animation of the events, but we want you to show the assailant as a white man? How would you respond to that?
Basically, the animation, we don't have an opinion about these particular cases. It's mm-hmm. all the opinion of an expert. And in a practical sense, because I'd already involved it with NBC, I wouldn't do anything mm-hmm. With them. But however, an expert, somebody who is going to present this information, who is going to be cross-examined in the trial, has to put their reputation about what their opinion is.
Right. So you don't just present an animation. You're going to be up there in the witness stand talking about how you made it and being cross-examined about how what decisions went into it.
Exactly. What the foundation was, what the data was, where did that come from, how were the measurements taken, what type of software it is, if the software is commonly used for these type of purposes. So there's a variety of hurdles that anything has to go through to be included in a trial, and the judge is a gatekeeper.
Mm. Let's go to Jim in Asheville, North Carolina. Jim, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
I always enjoy your show.
Thank you.
This is actually a very good follow-up to the last call of Ken. When Ken did his first case, State versus Pierce, I was a first-year law student, and I was recruited to participate in an experiment. I didn't know it was an experiment at the time, about the use of film in courtroom. And what it was a rape case, and the prosecutor at the time, this was a sort of like a moot court,
mm-hmm.
Showed a reenactment of the crime with a actor that resembled the defendant. The rest of the evidence was circumstantial, but that film and the way it was set made such an impression upon the jury that we voted guilty. And it was only after the trial was over and we had taken a survey about what evidence was weighed most on our minds, and we all chose the reenactment, that it was turned out that the defendant was actually innocent. And this virtual reality is very along the same vein as the film. And to me, that use is very prejudicial to a jury and can really make an impact far beyond its actual importance. And so as a practicing lawyer, I'm against it.
Can I comment on that?
Dr. Lederer, go ahead.
By word of quick explanation, the Courtroom 21 project includes the world's most technologically advanced courtroom, and we've been experimenting with this type of thing for years. Judge Rosenbaum earlier commented that, in effect, that the jury sees through a biased animation and a heartbeat. Our experience has been that you cannot win a case by an animation, and that, indeed, ordinarily, the jury will go ahead. Well, let me say consistently, the jury always goes with the weight of the evidence, and that the animation is helpful, but it is not determinative, and that's been consistent for years using very high-end animations. I have no doubt that a improper presentation of evidence can bias a jury, as our caller is suggesting, but given a reasonable judge's control, we see absolutely no reason to believe that this type of animation is in fact a problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, Jim, thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Brief mention, I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you're all in agreement then that this is the courtroom of the future. We're going to be seeing more forensic animations. We're going to be seeing possibly virtual reality. And it will be up to the judge, Judge Rosenbaum, to, as he always does, decide what to leave in and leave out.
Well, it's comforting to hear Fred Lederer refer to a reasonable judge. There are lawyers who would deny that such a creature exists.
Oxymoron.
I've had to work with you, and therefore know what a reasonable judge is, sir.
But the reality is that people are used to getting their information from screens. You go to a grocery store, and they scan your oranges. You get your money from a machine. Countless people have a computer at their desktop. That's how they find out what's going on. So people are used to that. I think they're also used to the fact that reality is reality, and what they see on there is some kind of an approximation of it. But so is my being under oath and telling somebody what I saw or had for breakfast. Then they have to make an independent decision. One of the great things that exists in the system that we have is that there are two sides. And both sides are bound, first ethically, but more than that, by the fact that the other side is monitoring what they're doing. When when Andre does a video, it goes over to Steven. And these guys are good at what they do. And they check out the other one. Frequently, rather than backstabbing the other one, they'll just get together and say, wait a minute, what about this? And they'll fix a problem because neither one of them wants to participate in a fraud. So basically, exactly. You're getting the information to people who then make an independent decision about it. Just because you saw it on television is not going to decide the case.
Let me get a quick question in before we have to go. Judy, quickly.
Yes. Well, I was just wondering along those lines if you've seen a case where both sides had their own animators that contradicted each other and what happened then.
Frankly, I've never had them on a substantive question, not on a major part. A little bit of difference, but nothing of any substance.
So there aren't that many animators out there doing this, or you know,
there's not that many firms. But one of the benefits about two animations is that it both focuses the message in each particular position, each party. This is my particular point, and so you can analyze it and you can see how they vary, and then that's left to the jury to decide.
Do you think we only have about 30 seconds left? Do you think that animators should be certified somehow as being reputable, as you do other people who testify in court?
Actually, we don't. No. We take people, and they have to show that they are qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes as simple as if you're walking down the street and I know you wear corrective lenses, before I will let you testify about what you saw at the intersection, I want to make sure you are wearing them.
So then you would grill the animator to make sure he's a reputable person.
Actually, the lawyer on the other side would.
Yeah, so it's up
to. And I think that needs to be done a little bit more often now, because as computer animation in general becomes more prolific, there is a greater number of, for lack of a better word, bad animations being commissioned by attorneys, and they're starting to slip into the courtroom, starting to fall between the cracks. So I think that attorneys need to rely more and more upon professional forensic animators to cross-examine opposing animations to ensure that what's getting in is actually quality stuff that's being used to illustrate the findings of competent expert witnesses.
All right, you've got the last word. I'd like to thank all my guests this hour, the Honorable James Rosenbaum, Chief Judge of the U.S. Federal District Court for the District of Minnesota, Stephen Brope, Forensic Animator at Perceptual Motion. I said the wrong words before. That's in Gig Harbor, Washington. Also, Andre Stewart, Forensic Animator at 21st Century Forensic Animations in Arlington, Texas, and Dr. Frederick Lederer, Chancellor, Professor of Law, and Director of the Courtroom 21 Project at the Marshall Wythe Law School, College of William and Mary. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Michael Cullen is our technical director. Our audio engineers are William O'Neill and Irene Trudell at the controls here in New York. Eric Bright in Dallas and Doug Patterson in Seattle. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And with help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, write to us at Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007. Or head over to our website at Science Friday. If you missed any of the links, they're over there. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
Science Friday is produced by National Public Radio and Samana Productions in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. For tapes and transcripts, call toll-free 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-8398.